Hello and welcome to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. My name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
And?
No, Lionel. We've got Richie, but no Lionel.
No Lionel. Lionel's busy. What's he up to?
Good question. Do you think we'll be able to carry it off without him? I think we might be a bit rusty today. And we've got some very experimental podcasting as well in the offing.
We're a bit like a tripod with two legs.
Yeah.
A bit wobbly. We're going to be led by you today, Daniel. Finally back from your Arctic adventure. That took a while.
Not really. It was. I've been back a while now. Well over a week. We've been a bit all over the place, haven't we? Physically, yeah. not metaphorically.
It's that post-tour sort of flux that we all find ourselves in with various work projects that we've fallen behind with and things that we have to catch up on. So apologies for the radio silence for a couple of weeks, I suppose. We'll try not to let that happen again. But Daniel, can you do a Lionel impersonation? Not a real one, but where are we? Where are we?
Oh, yeah, I've got to do that. I'm not going to do the Lionel impression, but we are in the National Theatre. I'm sorry, I can't be more colourful than that. What does Lionel usually say in this particular setting?
That's something along those lines. And when I said, where is Lionel, you should have, of course, said in his kennel.
Yes.
He was put in his kennel during the last podcast. Anyway, Lionel will be back next week. So the Vuelta is going on, and rather perversely, we are not going to go large on the Vuelta today, but we are going to obviously talk about it, but we're going to wrap it around some kind of Arctic race report, Daniel. How are we going to do this?
Experimental Arctic August Odyssey. We're going to go where no podcast has been before, no podcast, cycling podcast, has ever been to the Arctic Race of Norway, I don't think. I was there a couple of weeks ago, four-day race.
Second edition,
organised by ASO. And the first stage finished at the northernmost point of continental Europe, which was Nordkap, Cape North. The first ever GPM mountain Grand Prix, a mountain prize, the climb was entirely in a tunnel. That's the first for a professional race, I'm pretty sure. We're going to divide it up by stages. So first you're going to hear my special report from stage one, which kicks off with a scoop. It does kick off with a scoop, but most importantly,
there's
it kicks off...
There's a scoop in every section, I hope, Tanya. You were there for long enough.
Most importantly, it starts off with a conversation with friend of the podcast, Christian Proudhon, Prudy, the Tour de France director, who was in Hammerfest for the first stage of the Arctic race to give his backing to the event. He only stayed, 48 hours. But yeah, this is me talking to Prudy, and then we're going to hear a bit of summary of the first stage and a bit of Tour Hushovd as well. So here you go, straight in with this groundbreaking Arctic race reportage. Christian, we're here at the Arctic race in Hammerfest this morning for the first stage. First thing I notice is there's not much bunting.
That's true, but the only places I saw that bunting was in Yorkshire. So, but there are people happy to have the race, to have their race. The common thing I saw in Yorkshire and here is the pride of the people for the race. And when there is pride in the eyes of the people, that means that is not only the race, but their race. And that's true. That's the race of the people of Norway, for sure.
I just wanted to ask you one specific thing that we discussed in the podcast last week about the green jersey in the Tour de France. Sagan has now won it 3 years in a row. You changed the rules in 2010, I think, or 2009, to make sure that the best sprinter had more of a chance to win the green jersey. Is there any chance that the rules will change again this year?
I like your question very much, and we're working on that.
Really? So watch this space.
It's not. I think it's very good to have Peter Sagan winning 3 years in a row. It's no problem at all. And if he wins 10 years in a row, there's no problem at all. But you have to think about a rider who wins four stages and a rider who in no stages, and not that the rider who in no stages is ahead of the rider who in four stages, but the gap. For me, it's not the way that a rider, because we have to say that Peter Sagan was in the first five during the first 7 days of the tour, so that means something. That's very, very, very rare, but the gap is not possible. The gap is not possible between a guy with no stage wins, even with many, many performances, and a guy with four stage wins. Is that possible to have that gap? So, yes.
We can expect changes.
I gave not the order, but I said to our guys, work on that, please.
So we just watched Lars Petter Northug win a very spectacular first stage of the Arctic Race of Norway. Much more spectacular than we expected. We looked at the profile this morning and thought it might lend itself to some kind of sprint. Northug had other ideas. He attacked on the final climb, was very, very lively throughout the finale, in fact. And he ended up crossing the line 6 seconds ahead of Davide Villela of Cannondale, and also 6 seconds ahead of his teammate, Steven Kruiswijk. We talked about the possibility of it being a sprint today. Well, we thought Tor Hushovd might be one of the riders up there. It was the sort of puncher's finish that would have suited Hushovd, certainly in his heyday, but he didn't go too well. I think he's coming about 55th place, 56th place. I'm just looking at the results. And we're chasing after him actually through the car park by the finish line now, sort of windswept, very soggy car park. We're going to try and grab a word with Tor and ask him what went wrong today. So was that more or less the finale you expected, having seen the profile and knowing the terrain?
It was almost harder. Yeah. It was a really hard final. Also with the wind, obviously, made it tough. But I just didn't have a good day today, unfortunately. So I didn't finish like I wanted.
So with the form you had, you expected to be with the best guys on a finish like that?
Yeah, that was my... I knew it was a hard finish, obviously, but I was hoping I could do better than this. But I gave it everything, and that's what it is.
And just lastly, you think Belkin are going to be very difficult to beat on GC now?
Yeah, they are the strongest team, and Lars Petter apparently was the strongest guy out there today, so I think they're going to... Gonna win this easy. They should. It's never easy, but we're the best team and the best guy. It's more easy than the other way.
Thank you.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast: interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So, Rich, we heard Prudy there. We heard him talking about Zad Bunting. Is that any good? That impression?
Not bad at all.
Not only in cycling, but in the world, I think, who can make Bunting sound relatively sexy. I think that's certainly what some of our listeners think. Anyway, one in particular, I think.
Many.
Anyway, on with the serious business. We heard Prudy there talking about very likely changes to the green jersey competition. I said, I think, in the clip that the rule was changed in 2010 or 2009. It was actually for the 2011 tour, wasn't it? It was last changed to sort of favour Mark Cavendish. They wanted the best sprinters to have a better chance. It's been a bit of a sort of, not own goal, but it's ended up favouring a rider who's definitely not a pure sprinter, which is who's Peter Sagan. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, we have discussed it a couple of times, I think, already on the podcast. Just listening to what Prudhomme said there, it sounds like it is definitely going to happen.
Yeah, the challenge is how you make it happen. How do you tailor it? How do you engineer it to reward? And what is it supposed to reward as well? You know, there are very few riders with the sort of capabilities of Peter Sagan, which has almost created this problem. You know, he's a sprinter, but he can also contest quite hilly stages as well. You know, you have to go back to, I suppose, Sean Kelly in the 80s, no doubt. Lionel would have spoken a bit about Sean Kelly, but he was that similar kind of all-round rider. You know, when the field is just pure sprinters who are really in contention for the green jersey, it's a bit easier, and it's a bit more... there's a bit more of a guarantee that the most deserving winner will win it. So it's difficult. It's very, very hard. It's such a difficult thing to engineer. I mean, one thing I'd like to see reappear, and I know you would as well, is time bonuses, because I do remember the days in the 90s especially where the sprinters were not just contesting for the green jersey in that first week of the tour, but often for the yellow jersey as well. And it just added a bit of... added a bit more to that rivalry there was, and given the sprinters that we have, it would be great to see that edge to it.
Yeah, it's funny actually. I was reading, as you do, a copy of L'Equipe from 1987 the other day, and a big interview with Jack Godet, who was on his way out as the tour director at that time.
That was his final one, wasn't it?
That was his final one, and he was only there really as a sort of co-director. But he talked about how although he was not going to have any say in the matter in future or from that date forward, he would have liked to see more and more sort of spot prizes introduced, time bonuses, different types of classification. That was something that he was very, very in favour of, sort of contrary to what we might imagine might have been a kind of sort of more traditionalist perspective that he had. But, you know, going back to the green jersey,
and just on Gaudí, though, briefly, I mean, it is remarkable to think, my brain was whirring there, he was in charge from 1936. And you're talking about the 87 tour, and I remember that tour so vividly. It seems like a modern tour. And to imagine that he was the man in charge from 1936 and just how the race changed from that period onwards. He was certainly a bit more progressive and forward-thinking than his predecessor, Henri de Grange.
Yeah, I mean, you can read about the 1987 tour and how that tour was directed in the forthcoming cycling anthology, actually.
That might be what's keeping Lionel away today,
yeah,
is it?
I think it is. But yeah, perhaps one answer as far as the green jersey is concerned is, you know, bigger gaps between finishing first on the stage and second and third and fourth, because Sagan was certainly handsomely rewarded for finishing in fourth, fifth, sixth. But he's not looking too good at the Vuelta, is he, Sagan? There's been a lot of talk about his weight this week. Not sure how overweight he actually is, but, you know, when particularly the stage that Michael Matthews won, you know, it's a travesty, really, for Sagan not to be contending on stages like that. I mean, I'm sure he'll come into form in time for the World Championships in Ponferrada, but he's obviously not going particularly well. And it's been a bit of a... he sort of had a funny year. He's not really made any great progress this year. I was looking back at the feature I wrote about him earlier this year and said that he was in danger if he didn't really make a big step forward, win a monument this year, of looking more like the new Edvald Boasenhagen than the new Eddy Merckx. And that's
a nice segue, Daniel.
It would be a nice segue, but I think we've got more to say about
this.
Well,
do you think Sagan, I mean, he signed his contract with Tinkoff Saxo. How long is that for? 2 years? 3 years?
I think it's 2 years.
Any idea how much he's being
paid? About €4 million a year.
€4 million a year. So you just wonder if that'll be a significant increase on what he was on at Cannondale. You wonder if that might have affected his mood and his commitment over the last few weeks since the tour.
Yeah, and, you know, looking forward to next year, I mean, we know the sort of pressure that Oleg Tinkoff has put, certainly the highest earners in his team, under before, and Sagan might be in a bit of an invidious position next year if he doesn't up his game. But, you know, he could easily turn his season around by winning the World Championship. I think the World Championship is the big opportunity that's still left this year. But
I mean, it's interesting to say up his game, because he always appears to be on top of his game. This Vuelta is perhaps the first time we've seen him look not to be in the sort of condition where he could and should be winning. The failure to win has often not been because he's not been in shape, but just circumstances or unlucky or a slight tactical error or, you know, over eagerness. Whereas,
so you can say overeating there.
Well, you wonder, is he the new Jan Ulrich?
Yeah, I mean, that's,
he's got the body shape. Like, he could have, couldn't he?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what people were suggesting earlier this week. I mean, he's not as bad as Carlos Betancourt, who is in absolutely wretched condition at the Vuelta. Quite a few riders, actually. I noticed Damiano Cunego, I mean, a real sort of yesterday's man now, but he finished 15 minutes down in the first summit finish yesterday.
How's his knee, though?
Healing, I think, but he's really struggling to get a decent contract for next year as well, and one of several, you know, several fairly high-profile riders who are struggling to find employment next year.
So, Daniel, any more from the Arctic race? I'm allowing you to introduce it. I must stress to our listeners that we will be speaking about the Vuelta quite a lot, and you'll be hearing a nice new Vuelta jingle as well. So, yeah, don't look at me like that, Daniel.
We found a Spanish señorita to do the intros.
Indeed, we have.
Have,
yeah,
we? Really?
Yeah, we have. It's all under control.
Right.
So we'll hear from that, and we'll talk a bit about the Vuelta and how it's shaping up, because we've, as we speak, the race sort of hit the mountains very recently. We saw a first indication of, you know, who might be in form. As we speak, we hear that Chris Froome has had a little tumble today, and he seems to be okay, but I wonder about Chris Froome, but we'll talk about that later on. But Daniel, please introduce your next part from the Arctic race.
So we heard about the first stage of the Arctic race, didn't we? You were transfixed by that. We heard about Lars-Petter Nordhaug taking the leader's jersey after the first stage. The second stage was always going to be one of the, well, probably the least interesting of the days. We expected a Marcel Kittel win. It was a stage finishing in Alta. It was actually won by Alexander Kristoff. But I had a different sort of special mission that day. We mentioned Edvald Boasenhagen. Well, I wanted to speak to a few...
Did we?
We did. Yeah.
I don't think we've mentioned him yet.
We did. I said that Sagan was in danger of becoming
Yes. Yeah.
And I wanted to speak to some prominent figures in Norwegian cycling about Boasenhagen and where his career's at, whether he's plateaued, and what he should do next. No more prominent... Well, there's only one person I can think of more prominent in Norwegian cycling than Tore Hushovd, who is in the clip. He's the last voice you're going to hear. But also, there's also Dag Otto Lauritzen, also from Grimstad, and the first Norwegian to win a stage in the Tour de France in 1987.
87.
And Dag Otto...
It was Ardennes.
Yeah, and just to put this in context, Dag Otto, he really... His personality and his on-screen persona, because he was working for TV2 in Norway, really transcended the whole event in the Arctic. He was kind of... A sort of Norwegian Annika Rice for British listeners /Bear Grylls, jumping out of his car at every opportunity, accosting reindeer, accosting women in folk costumes, lassoing them, and women with fake breasts, etc., etc. And he was just a bundle of...
We get the picture.
Yes.
It's not a pretty picture.
he was absolutely fantastic to watch throughout the race.
Pretty back there to crossing reindeer. How did that work?
Well, he was kind of stalking these reindeer. They seemed to be the only people in Norway who were sort of immune to the charms of Dag Otto.
So are we going to hear this montage,
clip,
Daniel, and then are we going to talk a bit more about Edvald Boasenhagen? Because there's been some Boasenhagen news this
week. Yeah, we are. Just be patient. So the first voice we're going to hear is Dag Otto, the king of Norway, as far as I'm concerned. We're going to hear from the head of state of Norway later, actually, as you do in these special reports. So we're going to hear from Dag Otto. Then secondly, we're going to hear from Gino van Udhoven, who is the Belgian team manager of the Maxbo Bianchi team, which is the first team that Edvald Boasenhagen rode in as a professional cyclist. And thirdly, we're going to hear from Tore Hushovd, all giving their opinion on Boasenhagen.
I think he's a fantastic rider. He has the potential to be a great rider. And in the beginning of his career as a pro, he could win everything. You know, he was going in the attacks and he was doing good time trials. Quite good in the hills, but not the biggest hills. And in Sky, he has been working a lot as a domestic, but he had got some chance. But I think since the last 1.5 years, he has been suffering. Maybe mentally, or maybe his form and some problem with the Achilles. I think it's good for him to have a change, different team. Because he has still a lot to go. I think he can win big classics. I don't think he can win the Tour de France, but I think he can win smaller stage races, also Tour de Flandre and Paris-Roubaix. So I hope for him, and I hope for Norway, because he has a fantastic talent. He just has to maybe get his coach back. I know that when he has a start number on, he's a killer. But off the bike, he just don't care, you know. He loves drinking a coffee and he doesn't even know the names of his competitors. But I think, somebody need to push him a little bit in the back because he is not riding for money. He's riding to do results and then the money comes. But I don't know if he's lacking ambition or if he's just out of form or if he... done a little bit too much, so he needed to see Tore Hushovd also. He had some problems that he didn't know of for a few years. Never really come back. So that's sad because he's stopping. He didn't plan to stop now. He did it because he's been suffering so much, coming almost back and then going down again. I hope that's not the problem with Edvald, and I don't think so. I think he's coming next year.
I know Edvald really good. I know him as a person. So, of course, with us, he was on a different level, but of racing. But he was on a different level too. So you can, in fact, compare it a bit. And of course, Edwall can do more than he have shown the last 3 years. But like I say, everyone has a personality. He is very happy, you know. He has not grown up in a cycling community like Belgium or something, where Tom Boonen, and the biggest thing is to win Tour of Flanders. So he wanted to make a career, and that's what he is doing. But now, yeah, there's a lot of advisors around and everything who want him to see races, and I think he realized it too. So if I want to have a full good career, maybe I should win a Paris-Roubaix or something, and I think that's going around in his mind a little bit now.
Okay, so he's going to have more hunger, you're thinking?
Yeah, I hope so.
Now he's probably his most important year ever, because he haven't delivered the last couple of years. I mean, his level is not far, but things doesn't go his way, so I think it's a good move that he's leaving Sky and go somewhere else where he can get out his potential. So if I was him, I would really think and take the decision after only which team can help me to come back to my life. And don't care about money or the rest. Because he don't belong where he is now. He's such a strong rider.
Maybe what he lacked is the hunger that you always had. Motivation never seemed to be a problem for you to, you know, be a professional with 365 days. Like, Edvald doesn't maybe seem as ambitious.
Yeah, he seems like this as a person. He's one of the guys impossible to read as a person. So, but when he's on the bike, he has hunger. So I just hope that's he have this also when he wake up in the morning and decide what he had to do that day.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So we heard there in that second report, Daniel, two more still to come, by Edvald Boasenhagen. And of course, it's a good time to follow up on my exclusive from the podcast earlier this year that he would be leaving Team Sky. I did confirm quite a few months ago that he would definitely be leaving Team Sky. And let's focus on that part of the exclusive rather than...
team whose name was some kind of acronym that, with an NM in the...
It must have been a bad line. I was, you know, right. Can't be right all the time. or any of the time, but Edvald Boasenhagen is off to MTN Quebec, and not BMC as I understood it. But he clearly, his agent and he have been talking to teams all year, so not a great surprise that he is leaving. It's a bit of a step down, no, in terms of teams and setup. I know MTN are stepping up, but still quite a gap between them and Team Sky.
Well, apparently he was quite adamant earlier in the year, or his manager was quite adamant that he wouldn't drop out of the World Tour. He wasn't interested in going down to professional division. But that is what he's done. And, you know, you look at the invitations that MTN have had this year. They've ridden some very good races, the last 2 years, in fact. And I think they're now very confident that they will get a ride in the Tour de France next year. You know, they've got some... They've certainly got some riders with pedigree already. They've got Gerald Sielek, Linus Gerdeman, who's gone back there this year. And there's all sorts of talk of other riders joining. Tyler Farrar might go there next year. Kurt Aslar-Iversen, I think, as a direct sportif.
Interesting, because he's a coach at Team Sky, of course. Fellow Norwegian. Yeah, I mean, Boasenhagen has built a reputation at Team Sky as a very solid, dependable, often selfless rider, but I do think behind the scenes he's been quite frustrated at times at the lack of opportunities he's been given. He obviously had great opportunities in 2011 when he won two stages, which after Bradley Wiggins crashed out. 2012 he did a sterling job for him and for Mark Cavendish on stages. 2013 he crashed out and broke his collarbone. And that was a year, of course, Chris Froome won the Tour. The team was built around him. But the stage where he did crash, he was going for a sprint that he perhaps shouldn't have been going for, according to team orders at least. And you know, he was on his own. He wasn't protected by any teammates, and he crashed, as sometimes happens. So you know, perhaps the impression that we have of Boasenhagen isn't entirely accurate, and the decision to go to a slightly smaller team is purely and simply to get some more opportunities for himself.
Yeah, and I think the picture, as we heard there from Dag Otto, talking about the fact that he's got his old coach back, or he will be getting his old coach back. I know Sky over the years have tried various different changes with him, tried to train him in different ways. It's always really produced pretty similar results. Also mentioned in that clip was his Achilles problems, and Achilles tendon injuries these days tend to be about the most troublesome injury that any sportsman can have. You know, in the past it was perhaps, you know, knee issues caused the most problems, but now Achilles problems do seem to really sort of handicap riders. And
it's always been their Achilles heel.
Yeah, it always has. But there also, you talked about Hushov saying, you heard Hushov talking about how difficult he is to read, and, you know, even there, three people who know him very, very well, they're at a bit of a loss to explain what's happened with him. And, you know, perhaps he's the kind of guy, you know, we talk about riders who come through early and have too much pressure on them. Perhaps he's not had enough pressure put on him. It's difficult to say. He certainly needs to find new ambition, new stimulus, new motivation from somewhere, I think.
Right, let's hear part three, Daniel. What have you got coming up now in the box of treats that you brought back from the Arctic?
Well, we really amp it up now, because now we get into the real sort of nitty-gritty of the race.
I was wondering when that would happen.
This is where my ability as a tipster came in.
Tipster or hipster?
Tipster and hipster came in very handy, because I had a hunch that it was going to be all about Stephen Kruijswijk, the third stage, which was the summit finish, the only real mountaintop finish at the Arctic race this year. So Stephen Kruijswijk, the Belkin climber, he was in third place going into what was going to be the crucial mountaintop finish. Lars Petter Nordhaug, his teammate, was leading. And this clip features me in a helicopter, or me about to get into a helicopter. It features me almost crashing a hen party, and it also features me, I think, about to embark on a night
out
in Tromsø.
Not crashing the hen party in your helicopter, I hope.
No, sadly not. And they were going to. Anyway, you'll hear. I'm not going to ruin the surprise.
Can't wait.
So, shall we go? So, okay. So this is me. I think it starts in Alta, which was the town where stage three started, and here we go. So we're here in Alta before the third stage of the Arctic race. It's going to be the decisive one, probably. Stephen, third on general classification. Do you expect to be up there today and maybe even challenging your teammate, Lars Petter?
No, of course I expect to be there in the final. Yeah. And I think it's a stage that suits me, but as well for Lars Petter. So I think... No, he's still in the lead, so he's our main man to take the general. And I want to be up there as well, but we have to see if we have to work in the final or not. And the most important thing is that we defend the leader's jersey, and it stays in the team. And we have some options within the team with Yves as well. And hopefully we can help each other out in the final and make the best of it.
And last thing, just the experience of riding the Arctic race. Fantastic scenery, not many fans, lots of reindeer.
Yeah. It's weird riding here, but it's beautiful as well. And I'm glad I've took the chance to come here and I'm enjoying it.
So we're here in Alta before stage three of the Arctic race, and with a very important man today, Michael Elizen, who's the director sportif of Belkin. You've got two riders, Michael, who on paper very much in contention for the overall here, the leader Nordhaug and third place Kruijswijk. What's the tactic today?
I don't think the tactic is much different than the first day. I think we're pretty confident that uphill we have the strongest riders in the team. We showed the first day. That was also our goal and objective in the first stage, that we work for those for those three riders, because Hiver is also still in fifth place. We try to keep it together until the final climb. In the case a group rides away with the closest one on 10 minutes, yeah, then it's not up to us. I mean, GC is now most important for us. But on the other hand, I think if you, we're confident enough in Lars Petter and Steven that if we can begin the climb with a big group and with all complete, that we have the strongest guys to finish it uphill.
So we're at Alta Airfield, and that's the sound of my helicopter that I'm about to jump into and go to the finish of the third stage of the Arctic race. The unpronounceable finish of the third stage, the mountaintop finish, eagerly awaited. We're expecting Belkin to probably consolidate their dominance of this race with either Nordhaug or Kruijswijk, but In the meantime, we're going to get in our helicopter and hopefully enjoy the ride.
So at the end of our very, very spectacular helicopter ride, and at the end of stage three of the Arctic Race of Norway, we've seen Simon Spillak of Katusha win ahead of Stephen Kreuzweig of Belkin. We thought this was going to be a decisive stage. It looks as though it's going to be crucial as far as the general classification is concerned, because Kreuzweig has leapfrogged his teammate from Belkin, Lars-Petter Nordhaug, and Kreuzweig should now, we would think, sew up overall classification victory tomorrow in Tromsø. I'm not going to try and do the helicopter ride justice. No amount of florid podcasting would do that. Suffice to say, we saw lots of fjords, we saw mountains, we saw reindeer, we saw everything you would expect to see up here in the Arctic, and it was a very, very special and memorable day. And I've just seen Michael Elijan, who we spoke to this morning, of the direct sportif for the Belkin team, who masterminded that very fine performance by Stephen Kreuzweig today. We're just going to try and grab another word with Michael, who we spoke to in Alta this morning.
So Michael, we spoke to you at the start of today's stage in Alta. Everything went pretty much according to plan, except Lars-Petter perhaps not going as well as he hoped, but Kreuzweig has the jersey and is in a good position to take overall victory now.
Yeah, I think Lars-Petter wasn't good enough today, so you never can predict what the feeling of a rider is before you start the race, and up until today it seemed really good with Lars-Petter, but on the hill we saw that he was struggling, so... Yeah. Well, like I said, you have the big advantage of having two other strong riders just behind them.
And just last thing, tomorrow, the finish in Tromsø, there is a climb near the end of the circuit.
Yeah.
But with 8 seconds advantage over Lars-Petter and further, the other guys are further back. Yeah. Should be fairly.
I think it should be no problem. If there's no bad luck or crash or something like that, or something with the material, I don't think it will be a problem to win this tour. But we have to ride the stage, of course, and hopefully nothing will happen. But I think it's a comfortable situation, I think.
Now at the finish of stage three with a hen party of all things I've just stumbled upon, very fortunate from my point of view. Anyway, let's find out why they're here. You're not interested in bike racing?
No.
No. But why did you decide to come up here?
Because this is a once in a lifetime, and we live 1 mile from this place, so I think that this would be a perfect opportunity.
Okay. So what else?
Been seeing.
Right. What else is planned for the rest of the day?
Grilling and drinking by the river.
Right. What are you going to grill?
Meat.
Okay. nothing more raucous, nothing more, scandalous than that.
Some games.
Okay. And how many are you?
10?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So you haven't been converted as cycling fans? You're not?
No.
You haven't become new cycling fans? You thought it was, what, boring or?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Hopefully the hen festivities tonight will be more interesting. Thanks a lot. So hopefully you heard the giggles there of the hen party. I've managed to escape their clutches. I'm back in the peace and quiet of my hotel room alone, I must add. And we've just had a very long but very beautiful 4-hour drive to our hotel in Tromsø, where the final stage will take place tomorrow. Just looking ahead to that stage tomorrow, Kreuzweig is leading on general classification by 8 seconds from Nordhaug, his teammate. Vilela is third at 17 seconds, and Christoph is fourth at 21 seconds. So with only 10 seconds available as a bonus for the stage winner tomorrow, it's looking pretty good for Kreuzweig. He'll no doubt be resting up ahead of tomorrow's finale. We're off into the Tromsø night. We're off for a bit of an explore. It's about 11 o'clock in the evening here. Still very, very light outside. Very lively as well. There are lots of cruise ships in the harbour decanting tourists into the bars and hostelries of Tromsø. So let's go and see what it has to offer. And I'll maybe report back about that tomorrow, or maybe I won't.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
You know, so we heard me talking to the hen party there. I feel I really underperformed in that interview. I feel that was an opportunity that went begging.
It's a daunting prospect.
Yeah, it was. It'd been a very long day. The whole trip...
Even for a man of your charm.
Even for a man of my charm. But, you know, we'd spent most of the day in a helicopter. My senses were slightly addled by the cold temperatures.
I'm sorry, ladies, I've spent most of the day in a helicopter. Did that go down well?
Yeah, it seemed to go down okay, Rich, but the cycling, they didn't seem to like the cycling. They weren't at all enamoured, but there wasn't a huge crowd at that stage, or indeed at any of the stages, but very, very enthusiastic, and they really seem to embrace the Arctic Race of Norway.
Well, there's not a lot of people, are there?
No, it's hardly anyone.
It's a race for TV. I mean, it looks fantastic. The scenery is spectacular. You know, I tweeted it's almost on a par with Scotland.
It is, and it's quite similar to Scotland, particularly the first stage to the...
tongue-in-cheek, by the way, but it's true.
It is, to the Nordkapp. It's kind of... it was quite like the Highlands, and then, you know, the fjords are slightly reminiscent of places like Loch Lomond.
Still bigger crowds than Tour of Beijing, which I think is the last edition of that this year.
And bigger crowds than a lot of races. And, you know, I do think the race definitely has a future. Any historically races that ASO have backed definitely do have a future. And the Statoil, which is the big oil company which is backing the race at the moment, they've got another year on their contract. I was speaking to some of their executives before the final stage, and you know, they didn't want to commit either way. They weren't going to say whether they will renew the contract, but the feeling seemed to be that the future of the event, if not guaranteed, then it certainly looks pretty good.
And do you want to introduce part four, Daniel?
Straight on to part four,
because we need to talk a little bit about the Vuelta. It's right, only fair.
So, stage four, the crucial final stage. Kruiswijk, we heard there, was leading the race. The final stage looked as though it was going to be quite tricky. It was a circuit race with a nasty little climb, about 4K from the finish, a sort of San Remo-esque finish, a Poggio-esque finish. And you're going to hear me in Tromso, which was the venue for the final stage. First of all, again, I managed to pick the protagonist for this. I managed to nail that in the morning. I decided that Christoph
you can go to these races on your own and come back and see I got everything. I tipped everything. I can crash hen parties. I can ride in helicopters. I can wrestle with reindeer. I can, you know, sunbathe with Dagor to
Lord. I had a hunch that Alexander Christoph was going to win the stage, so I made a beeline for Christoph in the morning. And the first clip you're going to hear is me in Tromso with Christoph before the final stage, which he went on to win. Just quickly on the stage today, it looks like a good finish for you with the climb at the end. What should we expect from that finale?
Yeah, of course, I'm one of the favourites, so we will try to control, of course, with some other teams have for sure the same goal. Hopefully we can control the race and make it into a sprint. I think I have a good chance, but okay, is there any other sprinters here? If Kittel survived the climb, he can also win our tour. He had a good sprint in Alta, so I don't take the win in advance, but I know I have a good chance and I will go for it.
Yeah. This year your profile has grown a lot internationally, obviously with Milan San Remo and the wins at the Tour, but it must be nice coming back to Norway and realising that you're becoming more and more popular here as well.
Yeah, sure. I raced actually quite a lot in Norway. I did also Tour of Norway and Tour de Fjords, and now coming back after Tour to Arctic, fantastic that we have so many nice races here, and Arctic Tour have been really, really good organized and everything, so it was a nice experience to be here.
So I'm here at the final stage of the Arctic race. The chap you can hear, I think, is the mayor of Tromso. He's trying to whip up the crowd, no idea what he's saying, but about 20 seconds to go to the start, and let's watch them get the race underway. The final stage of the Arctic race from Tromso to Tromso is underway. We heard the start there of the final stage of the Arctic race from Tromso to Tromso, and we're just waiting for the race to come in now. We're standing by the finish line with a very, very special guest. It's the first for the podcast. It's Erna Solberg, who is the Norwegian Prime Minister, and we're just going to ask her now what this race means, the Arctic race of Norway, to her country.
Well, first of all, cycling has become an extremely large sport in Norway the last 15 years. And the most important part is the fund, the recruitment it leads to with a large race like this. But it's of course important for us to show off the Arctic areas of Norway, beautiful nature. Hopefully it gives more people the wish to come to Norway.
It will be very difficult, but do you think you can convince ASO to bring the Tour de France here?
Well, it could be. I'm not sure if it's easy because it's such a long way, but I mean, they were in Britain last year, so why not? If you sit 2-3 hours in a plane or 1-2 hours in a plane, it's probably not that big difference, but it could be a great start once.
just seen the final stage of the 2014 Arctic Race of Norway come in. Alexander Kristoff taking the win over Tor Hushov. That brings the week, the 4 days, to a close. You can hear the Norwegian fans there. Hushov's just coming through. He's just going to shake Kristoff's hand. Congratulations on that. You can hear the crowd giving a fantastic ovation for what will be his final race in Norway. Standing behind the podium with Stephen Kreuzweg, who is the winner of the 2014 Arctic Race of Norway. And that result has been confirmed now. Kreuzweg is going to win general classification by 4 seconds from Alexander Kristoff, who won the final stage there. We heard earlier in the day that ASO have laid on a surprise for Kreuzweg and a couple of others, Kristoff and Hushov, we think, are going to visit a seal sanctuary. And there was even talk of Stephen having to swim with the seals later on this evening. Just going to ask you, Stephen, how you feel about that.
I don't like swimming in this weather and with this temperature, so I don't know what the plan is, so I will be surprised what I will do. Yeah.
Okay. This is your first victory in a stage race general classification. Are you hoping this could be a breakthrough? I mean, you've been close before that there could be an avalanche of wins like this now.
I know that I won't be a winner. Will take a lot of wins in my career, and so I have to cherish these moments that I can win, and especially this kind of races. It's good for me that I can win in general classification, and I think it's really important to step in my career again to be back on this level of winning races, and hopefully the coming years I will continue like this.
So Hushov is getting on the stage now, saying farewell to the Norwegian fans who have supported him so well over the years, and you can hear that fantastic ovation that he's getting, and he looks quite emotional. Big Tor. He receives the Viking jersey, which has been voted for by people on Twitter, fans on Twitter, for, I'm not really quite sure what it represents. Try to ask the race press officer, Thomas Carriou from ASO, exactly what it's supposed to represent earlier. It's a kind of combativity prize. Anyway, that's gone to Hushov today. So that's going to be his last official prize in a race in Norway, and he's lapping up the applause. So that's just about it. That is the end of the 2014 Arctic Race, the end of my special report from north of the Arctic Circle. And we have ended up, of all places, in a seal sanctuary. It's been that kind of week. Very strange landscapes, some slightly odd racing at times. And we have finished up in this very bizarre setting. We're going to see Tor Hushovd, who we just heard from there, on the podium at the end of his last race in Norway, thanking the Norwegian public, and for some reason the organiser has thought it was a good idea and it would be a great photo opportunity for Hushovd to say his goodbyes to the press, the Norwegian press in particular, in a seal sanctuary. So that's where we are at the moment. We're about to watch him emerge through some double doors, and he's going to throw some fish at the seals, I think, and yeah, that might be the last you hear from me for a while, because I'm going to enjoy this spectacle.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis, we've got the big talking points covered.
Welcome back to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with me, Richard Moore, and Daniel Freeb. Lionel Burney will be rejoining us next week when we will be talking more about the Vuelta. I think we left Daniel there in a seal sanctuary. Daniel, you got out of there okay.
Yeah, but I kind of cut on again, some regrets about that, because I ended it before the real action happened, before that they started actually feeding the seals.
Did you make a better impression on the seals than you did on the hens?
Arguably I did, yeah. They certainly seemed more interested. But yeah, it was, as I said in the clip there, it was a surreal end to quite a surreal week. You know,
will you be going back?
I hope so. I'm not sure if ASO hear my special report, then I might not be invited again. But
I don't know. I'm sure there's a lot more to be done in Norway. Maybe I'll go next year and do the special report.
We go together.
Yeah, we go together. Absolutely.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast on the Vuelta a España with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Freeb.
Jackie, you heard there our Vuelta jingle, which you'll be hearing over the next couple of weeks. We had to play it eventually, having gone to all the trouble and expense of recording it. So anyway, Daniel, have you been watching much of the Vuelta?
I've watched enough to have an opinion on some things, yes.
That's good, because that's what we want. I mentioned earlier that the first summit finish, it was a strange... You're the mountain man. I mean, it was a strange climb, that. I'm not sure how indicative it was of people's form. We did see an astonishing performance from Alejandro Valverde, who did a lot of work at the bottom of the climb. It was quite a short climb, 5-6 kilometres. Mm-hmm. A lot of work at the bottom for Nairo Quintana, we thought. And then when the attacks started coming, Rodriguez jumped with about 600 metres to go, which, as it turned out, was actually a little bit too early. It was Valverde, surprisingly, who responded. Also Contador, who is back... having recovered from his broken leg. A great surprise, I think, to see him at the front animating the race. I just threw that in there because I know Daniel doesn't like that word. But contending for a stage win in week one, which is exactly what he said he wouldn't do. He looked strong. Quintana was distanced a little bit. Froome was up there. Froome looked okay. But Contador was a big surprise for me. And, of course, Valverde won the stage.
Yeah, You mentioned that it was a short climb. There are a lot of short climbs, ending stages in the Vuelta. We talked about there are 6 summit finishes, but a lot of them are quite short. They're not, you know, the 15, 20-kilometre climbs we generally get in the Tour. On paper, that should mean that they'll favour Valverde, but he's been quite adamant that he's going to support Quintana. And Quintana also tends to sort of ease his way into Grand Tours. He certainly did that at the Giro. He got ill halfway through. So Quintana, I think, will come good in the third week. There's not a lot of time trialing in this Vuelta. There's a 36-kilometre time trial. There's a 9.7-kilometre time trial, I think. And we've seen in the past that he's a good time trial as well. Froome looks as though he's in good form. Contador too. Contador's team looks stronger yet again. Mm. And
what do you make of Contador? I mean, you know, he had a couple of weeks at least off the bike with the broken leg, you know, during which time your condition does deteriorate a little bit, and especially with an injury like that, you can even lose a bit of muscle in that time. To see him up there yesterday was a shock.
I mean, that team is Saxo Bank or Tinkoff Saxo. They are
to get it right, or you'll incur the wrath of Mr. Tinkoff on Twitter.
I hope he's not listening with what I'm about to say. But anyway, they are defying conventional wisdom at the moment, in the sense that their riders are racing an awful lot. They've got a few riders who, whenever I see them on the start list at the moment, I'm kind of quite taken aback. Well, that's Rafał Majka. He's not riding the Vuelta, but he did very well in the US Pro Challenge in Colorado, having won the Tour of Poland, having ridden well in the Tour, having ridden the Giro. And as you say, Rich, Contador has come back very, very quickly from his injury. So, they've been remarkably strong throughout the year.
It augurs extremely well for the Vuelta. It has been billed as perhaps the best of the 3 Grand Tours this year, due to the fact that so many top riders are there for various reasons. And we could see quite a battle between certainly Froome, Quintana, Contador. You know, again, we talk about crashing. I don't know how much to read into the fact that Froome has fallen off today. He fell off the day before the Vuelta began as well. And, you know, a rider can lose not only the confidence and suffer the injuries that come with falling off, as they always do, but there's the aura as well starts to go a little bit too, I think. And I don't think that the riders will be scared of Froome, and he looked strong enough on that first climb to be able to react. He didn't look super strong. He didn't look as strong as we've seen him in the past, even at the 2011 Vuelta.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot in the past also about how Team Sky have struggled when perhaps patterns have been broken, or the sort of templates of what they expect racing to be like are sort of confounded, and the Vuelta will be a new experience for them, in the sense that the climbs come throughout the course. There are a lot of very unpredictable stages. I mean, I think that the geography of France in particular, when it comes to the Tour, is so well known that very few of the teams are ever taken by surprise. This Vuelta, if you look at the route, it's not just those 6 summit finishes. There are stages where no one knows when the drama and when the action could occur. And it'll be interesting to see how well Sky improvise. And you know, it's not going to be them controlling the race the whole time. I think they're going to have Movistar doing an awful lot of work, Saxo Bank as well. So that again could favour
Tinkoff Saxo.
Yeah, exactly. That could favour them. It could upset their rhythm. So it will be interesting to see how that develops. And you know, there are a lot of riders who, just behind those sort of top three or four that we expect to contend for the overall victory, who could spring a surprise as well. People like Fabio Aru, and Kelderman seems to be going well. Chavez seems to be going well for
Aru. Aru looked very well. Mikel Nieve looked very good as well for Team Sky. He rode the Tour, of course, but he could be one of those guys who's come out of the Tour in pretty good shape. You do see that sometimes, that they look better in their second Grand Tour. Rafa Michael, perhaps an example, but Nieve looked very strong on that first climb, and you know, as the race gets more mountainous, I'm sure we'll see more of him as well.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast on the Vuelta a España with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
So anything more, Daniel, to add to this podcast before I rush off for a train?
We've just heard some breaking news, haven't we, about Thomas Lundqvist, who was in the Arctic as well.
Yeah, it's not really breaking news, but he's announced his retirement, only 30 years old.
Is he joining a boy band? Is he fulfilling his long held ambition? I don't know if he's got a long held ambition. He always looks like he should be in a boy band.
He
with
looks,
Gerdeman.
Yeah. And yeah. Well, they've certainly got the aha looks going on, haven't they? Lofqvist, yeah, only 30 years old. He spent the last couple of years at YAM Cycling, having been at Team Sky, before that HCC Columbia, before that Francis Dujeux. And he made a very long and quite gracious sort of retirement speech where he paid great tribute to, in particular, Marc Madiot, Francis Dujeux, to everybody at HCC High Road, and also YAM Cycling. Didn't seem to really mention Team Sky, and I think his time there was a little bit of a disappointment for him. I think he joined that team before Bradley Wiggins had been signed, and he joined it believing that he would perhaps be given the chance to lead the team at the Tour de France, and I think Wiggins coming along spoiled some of his plans there.
Yeah, by all accounts, not a particularly easy guy as far as team management and mechanics, masseurs were concerned. Someone who had a reputation for being a bit of a moaner, or certainly very particular about you know, his equipment, and also
a moaner or a perfectionist. Moaning perfectionist.
We'll give him the benefit of the doubt, and we'll say he was a perfectionist. Also, someone who. Well, he's had a child now, I found out recently, and that there is a feeling among those who know him that his priorities shifted a bit. He's never really been as lean as he perhaps should have been, apart from, I think, for a brief spell when he was at Team Sky. But, you know, he came onto the scene with a real bang when he won the Circuit de la Sarthe, I think age 20, or he might even have been 19 in 2004.
I encountered him in 2004 when I went down to Nice to interview Bradley McGee, who was living in an apartment block with Baden Cook at the time. And I followed the three of them on a training ride. It was Cook, McGee and Thomas Lovquist, who was 20 years old. And he won the Tour of the Med as well that year.
Possibly, yes.
Can't remember. Apologies if he didn't. But anyway, he'd made quite a splash in his debut year. And they did a big training ride, like 5 hours, and then Lofqvist went off for more. He went and did another hour, and McGee said that was quite routine, that he did extra training on top of quite substantial miles, and he was very impressed by his dedication, but slightly concerned at his propensity to perhaps overtrain. And he actually mentioned that in his retirement speech as well, that he could certainly never have been accused of undertraining. And it is a post-viral sort of fatigue problem that he has, an illness that he has that leaves him permanently tired. He hasn't ridden a Grand Tour this year, and that is what has brought his career to a premature end. Health problems, and you know, it might have been something that has been exacerbated certainly by training too hard at times, and you know, that could have been motivated by his battles with his weight, I suppose. His body shape was not that of the very lean kind of Tour contender that we see now, and that's what he wanted to be. He wanted to be a Grand Tour contender.
Yeah, and he was certainly. And one of those Scandinavian riders, the Scandinavians have always had a reputation, or certainly up until the last few years, for training, for doing very long training rides, almost like the East Germans used to sort of of a quite low intensity, but you know, they go out in any weather, they would really butcher themselves. And that was something that was always said about Lovqvist. He would, you know, train in the snow, minus 10 degree temperatures, etc. But yeah, I think weight has always been a bit of a problem of his. I mean, in Norway, in the Arctic race, he certainly didn't look particularly lean. He was not really a factor in any of the stages, although it was the kind of race that in his heyday with a 6 kilometer mountaintop finish was always going to be the decisive stage. It was the kind of race that should have suited him, but he was nowhere there. But we wish him all the best.
He also said, interestingly, in his retirement speech, which was quite refreshing to hear, that you know, he, when he had the pink jersey at the Giro and lost it to the likes of Danilo De Luca and Denis Menchov, that he could at least look back on his achievements with pride. And he mentioned also that he'd chosen his teams based on their ethics over anything else. So some quite pointed remarks.
Just on that, Rich, you know, we heard in my Arctic race clips there that it was going to be Torshov's final race in Norway, so he's going to retire at the end of the season. And that was something that, you know, I was speaking to various people over the course of the week in Norway. Again, that was said about Hushov, that the feeling is that he was someone who didn't compromise his ethics. This is something that he talked to me about as well, and perhaps hear some of that in a future podcast.
Yeah, and he's writing a book as well, isn't he, Hushov, yeah, which could be quite interesting.
He claims it's going to be quite controversial.
Interesting. Well, listen, we better wrap up there, but Daniel, thank you very much. We'll be back with Lionel next week for more Vuelta chat.
Yeah, no, I will be going to the Vuelta, probably not next week, but in the final week.
Great, so we'll actually have live reportage.
A Spanish hen party.
Maybe you'll come back with some more clips, will you?
Exactly, helicopters, hen parties, you name it, seal sanctuaries.
I can see the demand being quite high after this. Well, Daniel, thank you very much for bringing that wonderful package back from the Arctic. We'll be back next week with Lionel Burney. So thank you very much for listening.
Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.